Okay, good afternoon, everyone. I drew the traditionally sleepy speaking slot of just after afternoon tea, where everyone's, you know, just starting to lose their concentration for the day. So hopefully I will keep you awake. And I think if I do that, I'm going to feel like I've succeeded in this talk. So my name's Ben. I'm the VP of Engineering at Open Kernel Labs. We're a startup company that grew out of research groups at the University of New South Wales and NICTA. Our company specializes in doing operating systems and virtualization software for embedded systems. So the aim of this talk, apart from just keeping you awake, is to convince you that virtualization, or with a Z if you prefer, is not just for data centers, clusters, server environments, but it's also a useful technology for embedded systems. So traditionally, I guess the data center is kind of one of the first places that virtualization's really been used in. You know, big clusters, big farms like this. But we can also get a lot of value from these ideas and techniques in designing consumer electronics and embedded systems in general. So virtualization actually means a lot of different things to different people. And I'm going to spend some time explaining, firstly, what, for me, what virtualization is. Then I'm also going to explain a little bit about, from a high level at least, how virtualization is implemented. What does it take to make a hypervisor or a virtual machine monitor? Then going to go in a little bit about why would you care about using virtualization in general and specifically for these embedded systems. And throughout this talk, there's going to be a little bit of a who, the people that are involved in virtualization, and also interesting, a bit of a when some of these ideas came to light. So I have a feeling that some of the information that I'm going to be giving in this part of the talk is probably going to be repeating stuff that other speakers have explained earlier in the mini conference. So I don't know how many people have sort of been here the whole way through. Hopefully I'll be coming at it from a slightly different angle, from sort of my own perspective as a researcher and implementer of these systems. So hopefully there will still be some value there, even if you've sort of heard this 5 times already today. So we're going to start off with a little bit of CompSci 101 to sort of explain the what of what a virtual machine is. So a virtual machine is an efficient, isolated duplicate of a real machine. This definition was, I guess, defined by Popek and Goldberg back in 1974. So like all good ideas in operating systems research, this was done long before I was even born. So let's get into a bit more detail about what's involved there. Firstly, a virtual machine has to be a duplicate of the real machine. So what this means is that from the software running on top of the machine's point of view, it should be essentially indistinguishable from running on an actual real machine. So there are some caveats there. Obviously, you're going to have fewer resources available to the system, but it should, apart from that, be indistinguishable. So from that sort of definitional point of view, you should be able to run any OS that runs on the real machine should just be able to run on the virtual machine as well. Another really important part of this definition is the isolated part. So what this means is that these virtual machines should be isolated from both each other and the real machine, underlying machine as well. So this means that the virtual machine should not be able to, you know, interfere with the operation of other virtual machines. They shouldn't be able to, in some way, modify the virtual machines or in any way impact on their operation. Probably in the strictest sense, it really means that one virtual machine shouldn't even be able to determine the existence of other virtual machines that might happen to be running on the real machine. Finally, it needs to be an efficient duplicate. It's no good if it runs 1,000 times slower. That's sort of not really what we have in mind when we're thinking about virtual machines. Now, obviously, the performance of a virtual machine is going to be less than that of the real machine if it's sort of sharing those resources. But what we're sort of getting to here is that the aggregate performance of all the virtual machines shouldn't be much less than the performance of the underlying real machine. So in previous, I guess over the past few years, there's been a lot of hype, you would say, around virtualization. You have VMware IPOing for, what was it, just over $1 billion. You have ZenSource being bought by Citrix for $500 million. With this kind of thing going around, everyone wants their software at the moment to be virtualization software. So this is fine, but it sort of gets us to a position at the moment where virtualization can mean such a wide variety of things that it becomes almost meaningless as a definition by itself. So I want to go through some of the things which are either confused with or being branded as virtualization and just see sort of how they compare back to this original definition of what a virtual machine is, what a virtual machine monitor does. So one thing that's kind of like virtualization is simulation. This is where you have some bit of software, the simulator, that provides a fully accurate model of a piece of hardware. This is really great if you're a hardware designer trying to work out all the properties of this simulated machine. It gives you this fully accurate model. It's sort of got a good advantage that you can run it essentially on any machine. You can simulate an ARM processor on an x86 machine, no worries there. The problem with this, and the reason this sort of doesn't really classify as virtualization, is that it's really slow. You're talking 1,000 times slowdown here. So simulation is a great tool, great if you're a hardware designer, but not really what we'd sort of count as traditional virtualization. Along the same lines, you have emulators. Now, emulators, rather than giving you a fully accurate model of the underlying silicon, the underlying machine, it provides a behavioral model. So from the software running on top, it's it looks the same, but it's taking shortcuts underneath. So it's not fully implementing all the caches, these kind of things. It's taking some shortcuts there. Now, these shortcuts means that it's actually reasonably fast, but we're still talking about 10 times slowdown, and 10 times slowdown is not really what I would class as an efficient duplicate of the real machine. So again, emulation, really useful, especially if you're trying to bring up a new operating system, debug some low-level code, but not what we'd call virtualization. So in comparison to these, the virtual machine is modifying the machine exactly and efficiently. The slowdown is minimal, much less than 2 times. You're sort of talking 5, 10, maybe 20% overhead. But virtual machines, there's a lot of hype around them, but they're not all things to all people. Compared to those previous things, you've got a real sort of potential disadvantage where the virtual machine has to be running on the same hardware as the physical machine that it's presenting. You can't sort of present an ARM virtual machine on an x86 processor. So there are sort of some other things that are also sort of called virtualization. One of these is for example, language virtual machines, things like the Java virtual machine or the Python bytecode interpreter. These are all sort of termed virtual machines. The reason that these sort of don't match up to our theoretical definition of a virtual machine is that the interface that they provide to the software running on them is vastly different to the underlying interface that the real machine provides. So, and this is great. This is why people use the Java virtual machine, because they can have software that is going to get that interface wherever it's running. But again, from that point of view, when we talk about virtualization, true virtual machines, this isn't the kind of thing that we're talking about. So another thing that's got this virtualization tag at the moment is these kind of OS virtual machines. Now in these cases, what we really have is something like BSD jails or the Linux vServer. In these cases, you have one real machine underneath and one OS running on it. And the sort of virtualization that you get is that the actual view of the file system that user programs see are isolated from each other. So this is sort of useful, but you can't, for example, run a whole new operating system in a BSD jail or a Solaris Stone. You can only run programs that are designed to work with that OS. So while these are really useful, I think it's actually great technology for server consolidation. This is probably a much better approach on some levels than true virtualization, but it's worth distinguishing these solutions from sort of more traditional hypervisors. And another sort of similar to virtual machines that's often confused with them is where you have co-location. And what happens here is you essentially end up with two operating systems, both running on top of the hardware at once, and more or less cooperatively working between themselves to utilize the hardware. So some examples of this would kind of be RT Linux. It kind of has this real-time sub OS inside the Linux kernel that it's managing to interact with Linux to share. There are some hypervisors which offer this as a potential way of running your virtual machines. Now, the real reason that this doesn't really fall under our original definition is that while it gives you a duplicate of a real machine and it's definitely efficient, it's really missing the important aspect of isolation. So without isolation, it's sort of hard to class that really as virtualization, and instead we have this term co-location. Okay, so I want to go a little bit into, well, how do you do virtualization? How do we sort of get this situation where on this real bit of hardware we suddenly have these two virtual bits of hardware, two more n virtual bits of hardware? So the kind of a couple of options for how the software stack works. The traditional model is like this. Usually, you know, you have your real machine and the operating system runs on top of it. When you, to sort of implement the virtual machines, you add in this extra sort of layer of hardware called the virtual machine monitor, also known as the hypervisor, and that manages to slot in between the real machine and the OS. And you sort of see here that it's presenting the same API, the same interface up to the OS. So this is sort of one model. Another model that is pretty widely used is where instead of the VMM sort of slotting in underneath the OS, it actually runs hosted on another existing operating system. So examples of solutions like this are, you know, the typical VMware where on your desktop you're running, you know, Linux and you run VMware player, and all of a sudden you can have the virtual machine run Windows in it or whatever. So that's sort of two approaches of virtual machines there, and they both have their sort of trade-offs there. So now I want to get a little bit into, well, what's this VMM or hypervisor actually doing when we when the system's running? What's it doing to create this illusion of multiple virtual machines and the one real physical machine? So to do this, we need to go do a bit more CompSci 101 and sort of go back to, well, what actually is a CPU? What does a CPU do? Well, really, all the CPU is doing is churning through one big, never-ending list of instructions. So, you know, when you take some code here and compile it, ends up in a bunch of instructions, and it's those instructions that the CPU, every cycle, you know, goes through and executes. So the sort of interesting thing from a virtualization point of view is that these instructions fall into a few different classes, which become really important from the virtualization point of view. So before we can kind of talk about that, we need to talk about privileged state. Now, privileged state is some state inside the CPU that is really sort of defining how the programs will be run. It's implementing the security. So typical examples of some of this privileged state in a CPU is the memory management unit and the TLB. This is the thing that takes care of translating physical RAM addresses into virtual addresses which the program actually uses. It's an important part for security. It's how the operating system provides isolation between different processes, different applications running on top of it. And it's a part of privileged state. You don't want any user application being able to modify the state of the MMU, or basically the whole underpinnings of your security are shot. So privileged state becomes important because we have what's called sensitive instructions. Now, sensitive instructions are any of these instructions that the CPU executes which can either modify this privileged state, change it in some way, update it, or, just as importantly, in some way expose the underlying physical state of the CPU. So this becomes very important for virtualization because it's these sensitive instructions that we need to do something with when we do virtualization. If the sensitive instructions can run directly on the CPU, then they're going to be modifying the state of the real machine for all the virtual machines. So they become pretty important. Which gets us to privileged mode. When a CPU executes, it can execute essentially in two modes. One of them is privileged mode, one of them is unprivileged mode, sometimes called kernel mode because that's where the kernel runs, and user mode because that's where the user applications run. Now, privileged mode is pretty important because there are these privileged instructions. And privileged instructions are instructions that will only run in privileged mode. So basically, if you try to execute one of these privileged instructions in one of your applications, it's not going to work. It's going to cause an error. So, you know, some examples of that would be something to modify the contents of the TLB, turn interrupts on or off. Any of these kind of things, if you end up doing them from an application, you're going to be able to sort of trash other applications that are running on the system. So the CPU introduces this privileged mode and these privileged instructions to avoid that. So with all this sort of in mind, we can actually get to, I guess, a bit of an understanding about what it means to do virtualization. So essentially, the way virtualization works is that anytime you get a privileged, instead of running your OS in kernel mode, it actually ends up running in user mode. And now, normally your OS expects to execute some of these privileged instructions. And what happens is that when it executes one of these privileged instructions, it causes a trap, which the hypervisor is then able to try and work out what the OS was trying to do, and then basically emulate that behavior. So it's really, we sort of come to this another theorem by Popek and Goldberg, which says that basically for any computer, a virtual machine monitor can be constructed if the set of sensitive instructions for that computer is a subset of all the privileged instructions. So sort of think about what that means is, anytime you execute a sensitive instruction, that's something that can either modify or expose the underlying state of the real CPU. So you don't want to be able to let an OS that's running in a virtual machine be able to execute one of those instructions, because if you do, it breaks the illusion. It's no longer seeing the virtual machine as being able to get access to the real underlying machine. So as long as all those instructions which lets you see the underlying machine are privileged, that means you can't execute them in user mode, then you're able to implement this hypervisor just by trapping all those privileged instructions. Now, this is great, and we have a sort of another term for this, which is pure virtualization. If you're able to do this for an architecture, you're able to implement pure virtualization, which is what something like KVM does. Unfortunately, there's a whole bunch of unvirtualizable architectures. So these are CPU architectures where that previous theorem doesn't hold. That is, there are some instructions which can access the sensitive state of the system, but won't actually provide any trap. And this is pretty much every architecture that's sort of available at the moment. x86, MIPS, Itanium. All of these architectures, you can't, at least in their normal mode, you're not able to actually virtualize without, because these sensitive instructions don't actually perform a trap. So to get around that, and really the only reason we have the term pure virtualization is so that we can kind of have the opposite, which is impure virtualization. Now, with impure virtualization, rather than the virtual machine monitor providing an exact duplicate of the underlying machine, it provides an almost exact duplicate of the underlying machine, except for some bits. And what we do with, in these cases, is that when this happens is we're no longer able to run an unmodified operating system on top of the virtual machine monitor. So there needs to be some modification to the OS in this case. So strictly speaking, this impure virtualization, if we go back to the original definition, is not really not really providing virtual machines, because they fail on the duplicate criteria. Now there are some different ways in which a virtual machine monitor can, or virtualization solution can address this. One of them is really cool. All you have to do is basically monitor what code the operating system is trying to run on the fly, and then change it so that it's not actually using any of these sensitive instructions. It's a great idea. I wish I thought of it earlier. Unfortunately, I didn't, and there's this nice patent stopping anyone using it that's held by VMware, so we sort of have to look at other ways of doing this. And probably the one that most of you here are familiar with is power virtualization. And this is the kind of approach that, for example, Xen took. It's the approach that OKL4 takes, where you actually go and modify the operating system, in some cases quite radically to actually run on your virtual machine. Now, of late, the software companies weren't to be sort of outdone of being on the hype bandwagon of virtualization. So we now have all hardware providers sort of coming out with hardware solutions, what I've sort of dubbed re-virtualizable architectures. So we have VTX for x86, which adds bolts on to the side of the x86 architecture, some hooks that actually provide a new mode so that you can actually crack on every sensitive instruction. ARM has something called Trust Zone, which does a similar thing. Itanium has something called VTI. I don't know if MIPS has anything yet, but they probably will soon, given the trend. Okay, so that's sort of given a bit of an overview, high level of, you know, how virtualization works. The next thing is to go into a little bit of the why you would want to use virtualization at all. Why is there all this hype around it? Presumably it's not, you know, presumably it's grounded. Presumably the, you know, venture capitalists, you know what's happening, and they have a good reason to want to fund these things. So one of the, don't laugh. one of the main reasons for virtual machines is to consolidate hardware. Rather than having to have a separate server for, you know, each service that you're providing, you can put them all onto one server. It's going to save you, you know, can reduce administration costs, has great power saving advantages, a whole host of advantages there, which I'm sure the people who are using virtualization in the data center can attest to and know a lot better than I do. Virtualization is also being used on the desktop. One of the main reasons for this, most popular recently that probably everyone here has used in sort of some fashion, is you're running one operating system and you want to be able to run another operating system at the same time for testing, or because there's just that critical app that you need to use. So that's one reason why it's being used by people quite extensively on the desktop. Another kind of new use of this on the desktop actually is being able to provide managed desktops. So this sort of popular in corporate environments, so that rather than running, you know, your Windows instance directly on the hardware, you run it on top of some hypervisor, which then means IT can come along, log into the hypervisor, and reinstall Windows when it crashes, rather than having to go over there or hope that Windows is still alive enough to log in, these kind of things. So virtualization seeing a lot of use there, which gets us to, well, why on earth would you want to do virtualization on something like a phone? What's the reason for that? Well, one of the reasons is pretty much the same as what you have in the server environment. It's consolidation. The difference here, though, is that rather than sort of having a whole bunch of services which are, I guess, more or less identical, which could end up being on any bit of hardware, you end up with really different types of operating systems that you want to run on one device. So a typical example of this is in a handset. There's two critical but, I guess, almost opposite types of, use cases, workloads for the OS to handle. On the one side, you have the graphical user interface, the GUI that the user's actually trying to interact with. It has all the PIM software, the thing that will play YouTube, look at Google Maps, all this great stuff. But at the same time, on the same device, you actually need to you know, be a phone, be able to talk to, you know, wireless telecom towers, have the real-time capabilities to actually obey the protocol, obey the specs so that you're actually able to run. So with these two almost competing, on the one side you have this rich, full sort of Linux environment. On the other, you want something that's time critical, sensitive, and also importantly needs to be isolated from the user interface. So there are sort of different ways of approaching this in a device. One way is that you can have multi-core, where on one core you run Linux or whatever, on a separate core you're able to run your real-time operating system. This works well, except that now you need to pay for a more expensive chip in devices where, you know, the people kill over, you know, a cent in royalty for a part. You also need more battery power to handle having multiple cores. So it's kind of the same arguments for wanting to reduce the number of servers in your server room are really just applied again to reducing the number of cores that you want running in your device. So if you're able to co-locate and have both the RTOS and Linux running on the same core, there's sort of definite and very real savings there for a manufacturer. But the problem with having both of these on the same core is you have an issue of isolating the workloads. For the CDMA protocol stack, it has some reasonably tight timings that it's got to obey to actually keep up with the protocol. And regulators also get very sort of, how to put it, worried about these devices have a very powerful wireless modem, you know, wireless transmitter in them. Authorities want to be pretty certain that that wireless transmitter can't be hijacked and used for some other, you know, not so nice use. So being able to actually isolate an application operating system like Linux from a real-time OS is really important. So now you might think, well, Linux is pretty secure, you know, what could go wrong? Well, I think we sort of, even on phones where, you know, you're not downloading any new software, there's been exploits recently of something like libjpg, for example, where if you just read a malformed JPEG image, you're actually able to start running arbitrary code in whatever context that JPEG image is being run. So this is obviously something that, you know, people like the FCC sort of care about and worry about and want to make sure that something like that isn't going to lead to a hacker being able to access the wireless transmitter in a phone. So if we go back to our definition of virtualization, remember that isolation is one of the sort of key attributes of a virtual machine. So you can sort of see how a hypervisor solution with you know, running two virtual machines, one for the real-time OS and one for Linux, can be used to solve this problem. So are there any limitations that you'll find when you're trying to do such a system? So that's sort of the good side of virtualization. Are there any sort of drawbacks? Well, turns out there are a couple. Now, isolation is great, because it stops that situation of, you know, some bug in one OS infecting the other OS or being attacked through the other operating system. But in a system like a mobile phone, for example, you can't have just two fully isolated operating systems. That works fine for a server environment where they're really running different things. They don't need to interact. But in a phone system, you know, your dialer application needs to be able to tell the real-time OS to actually initiate a call. You need to be able to transfer data from that's coming in over the air into the IP stack that's running. So it turns out that most of the time there ends up being a lot of communication involved between the operating systems to actually get a useful product out there. So having this isolation stops the attack, but it's also going to stop the application and the OS communicating, which basically means it's sort of dead in the water from a solution point of view. So what you really need is something that will provide the isolation, but also provide a way for communicating. And that communication ends up needing to be quite a high bandwidth. There's actually a lot of data that needs to be pumped from one side to the other. And it also needs to be relatively low latency to get a voice call that doesn't sound real choppy. You want that to be quite quick. So high bandwidth and low latency communication between processes and things, isolated bits of software running on the same CPU, is really something that microkernels have been doing for a very long time. So for those that know you, you are probably wondering when the microkernel rant would come into this talk. Here it is. Microkernels offer something more than just what a hypervisor can offer, because it enables you to actually communicate between the different virtual machines in a high bandwidth, low latency manner. So what you really need for these embedded systems is isolation as well as communication. So another kind of limitation to if we're just using a pure hypervisor design comes in when we start thinking about the trusted computing base. Now the trusted computing base is the set of all code that any particular application needs to trust for its security properties to remain valid. So if you're an application that's running on Linux, you need to trust all of the Linux kernel. You might need to trust some of the daemons that are running as well, if they have special privileges. What's sort of in security sort of terminology, the aim is always to reduce the trusted computing base. So you want to reduce the amount of code that you actually need to rely on to operate correctly. And this is one of the limitations of a hypervisor and virtual machine situation. If we look at this diagram again, if this was going to be just a pure, if you're running this on dual core, for example, our CDMA software on your right there would just be running on the real-time OS. So the amount of code that it had to trust, that was its trusted computing base, would be, you know, maybe the 5,000-10,000 lines of code that are in the RTOS. When you add a hypervisor into the mix, you now not only need to rely on the RTOS itself, but you also need to rely on whatever code is in the hypervisor, which, you know, could be 5,000-50,000 lines of code. So just having a hypervisor and a virtual machine solution doesn't really increase your security just by itself. So this is again where something like a microkernel can actually address and complement some of the features of hypervisors. So in a microkernel-based system, you're actually able to run applications. For example, it might be some security-sensitive application, something that's storing the encryption keys for your bank account or for some sensitive data, what have you. In a microkernel-based solution, what you're able to do is run those applications directly on the hypervisor on the kernel itself without having to add in, you know, an RTOS as well just to be able to run some application code. So this has the advantage of actually reducing the trusted computing base as well as isolating that bit of code from any other code in the system. So in summing up, virtualization is definitely a useful system design tool for embedded systems, but by itself, it's not going to be sufficient. A microkernel-based solution gives you the ability to take advantage of virtual machines while also enabling efficient inter-VM communication and reducing the trusted computing base as well. Now, of course, you might not believe me here, so if you don't, I suggest you go to Gernot's talk on Wednesday, which is the Do Microkernels Suck talk, for some what will probably be lively debate. And that is it for me. Any questions? So the question was, how do you actually implement communication between a process running on Linux and another thread running directly on the microkernel? So that is the idea. There are, in some cases, tricks you could play to enable a process running on Linux to actually, let me start again. There are ways in which you could structure your system so that an application was running, rather than running directly on top of Linux, it would run on the microkernel and be sort of a first-class application running on the microkernel, but you would be able to set it up so that it can use some of the services that the Linux kernel provides, like file systems, you know, network stacks, and those kind of things. There's not too much motivation to allow a process that's strictly running on top of Linux to be able to communicate with another thread in the system without involving the Linux process, because the Linux kernel itself, because really the Linux kernel is sort of the master over everything it creates. It could do whatever it wants to sort of intercept that or even let it go through, pretend it works, and then somehow suck out the data and that kind of thing. So the only reason you want to do that is to provide the isolation, which is sort of what I mentioned just before. Yeah, at the back. What particular qualities? So I think your question really brings up a really important point, which is we have a trusted computing base. Just sort of by definition, that's the amount of code you have to trust. You sort of can't get around that. What is sort of important is that there are different, just because you have to trust some code doesn't actually make it trustworthy. You might have to trust the Linux kernel, but it might have some, you know, tainted module in there which screws up the whole kernel entirely. If you're an application running on top of that kernel, you don't have any choice in whether you trust it or not, so it's part of your trusted computing base, but it definitely isn't a trustworthy bit of code. So I think your question kind of boils down to what would make a microkernel more trustworthy as a code base than a hypervisor system. And I think there are a couple of different answers to that. And it really comes, I think, from a strict design point of view, I guess there's not really any difference. From some implementation points of view, microkernels that I've had experience with versus hypervisors I've had experience with, the microkernels were on the order of maybe 10,000 lines of code, the hypervisors sort of significantly more, 50, 60,000 lines of code. So from just say software engineering, for any piece of code, you've got a bug density of what, maybe one, two bugs per 1,000 lines of code. Without knowing anything else about the software, the smaller software on average is going to be the more trustworthy one. But there is no reason why you couldn't have a hypervisor which is as small as a microkernel. So that argument kind of goes away. One way in which you really can gain trustworthiness over some bit of code, well, there's a bunch of different ways. One, you know, testing is one, static analysis of the code is another. And for all these, you see, need to more know about the processes that were involved in creating the software than the design and the software itself. Oh, exactly. I'm not trying to... I totally agree. None of those are qualities of the microkernel per se. There is... I don't think there are any qualities of the microkernel versus the hypervisor that inherently make one more trustworthy than another. Andy Tannenbaum and I agree on a lot of things, but some things we don't agree on. I see no theoretical reason why you couldn't build a hypervisor that's as trustworthy as a microkernel. And there are different levels of microkernels as well. You know, Mark on one end was a pretty fat microkernel. So, you know, there are levels and sort of in all this. So, but just to continue briefly, got a few more minutes on the trustworthiness of code angle. This is actually one of the research projects that is being done at NICTA at the moment, which is to formally verify a piece of code using mathematical and formal methods. And I would assert that if you do this, you have a very sort of sound reason to have a high level of trust in a particular piece of code if it's been formally verified. So that is what would give you some code that you not only have to trust, but that you'd be sort of willing and comfortable to trust. And again, the research that we're doing is based around a microkernel, but I don't see any inherent reasons why it couldn't be done to a pure hypervisor as well. Yeah. Okay, yes, there are definitely leaky abstractions, and there are cases where, the better the virtual machine implementation is, the hopefully the closer to the real machine it is. Obviously, I mean, if it's really a duplicate of the real machine, then there wouldn't be any problem. But obviously, that sort of duplicate is attribute is something we more aspire to than can ever truly achieve. And sort of the reasons, you know, there's you know, code that relies on the exact layout of caches at any point in time. And most virtual machine monitors and hypervisors don't do a very good job of strictly virtualizing the caches to the point where, you know, it would be indistinguishable. So it's a potential problem. It's not one that we've sort of really come across enough to actually worry us yet. It sort of, I guess, at least at the moment, has been a theoretical rather than practical problem. I'm sure that we will come across a case where it is a real practical problem. And in those cases, most of the time, if you're doing paravirtualization anyway, you have access to the source code to sort of rectify the valid or invalid assumption that the original programmer made. If you don't, there are still some tricks you can do with binary rewriting. And there are also tricks you can do with the allocation of resources to that thread. Actually, this is sort of, I mean, you can actually set it up that thread actually, I guess, gets, or that virtual machine gets more direct access to the hardware such that those leaky abstractions don't become a problem. Of course, you're trading that off against sort of, well, okay, for some period of time, it's got full access to the hardware, and that might require some level of trust of that code, but yeah, I guess it's a problem. There are ways around it. Cool. Well, if there are no... Oh, sorry. Yes. The kernel that we use is the... the OS that we use is the OKL4 operating system, which our company distributes. It's a based around the L4 microkernel, or one of the many L4 microkernels that exist. The one that we have currently at the moment is not. The one that we're developing with the goal of verifying very much is. It's not very easy to go and formally verify some arbitrary piece of code, but if you're able to actually craft the code in such a way that you make it amenable to verification, then it makes the problem somewhat close to tractable.